This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, where shopping is an art, celebrating 40 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March 3rd through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com, and by the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to music by guitarist Clark Salisbury. Nothing binds you together nor tears you apart like family, especially if it's a Sam Shepard family. Our Shoes Are Red, the Performance Lab, brings you True West, Shepard's tale of sibling rivalry. Today, a talk with artistic director Devin Allen and actors Matt DiBiasio and Kenneth Baldino, who portray the two brothers. Then, in the latter part of the show, we have a new Writer's Read segment with writer Bing Bingham in Central Oregon, plus a ticket giveaway. So stay tuned. This is Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts, stage and studio. With me today are Devin Allen. Hello. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Matt DiBiasio, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
And Kenneth Baldino, welcome to stage and studio.
Thanks.
Hey, great to have you all here. Now, we're setting the stage here. Two estranged brothers. They haven't seen each other for 5 years. Austin, which is played by Kenneth, you, Baldino, and he's a writer. He wants to write, I guess, a great American screenplay, and he's house-sitting for his mom, who is vacationing in Alaska. And then who shows up but Lee, his brother, he hasn't seen for a long time. He's a drifter, a thief. He's been living in the desert. So what ensues after that? What happens when they, when he shows up at the door?
Just massive amounts of tension.
it starts off with conflict, doesn't it?
A lot of unspoken stuff. A lot of touchy history.
The air's heavy with it.
So the two ultimately, it's interesting because I have seen a few productions of this Sam Shepard play, and the two ultimately, you know, go through a lot of. They wreak havoc on each other, but they start to work on the screenplay together, too. So it's this creative collaboration that starts happening.
In a sense, yes. I'm not sure how collaboratively it is.
So there's creativity and destruction all mixed together there.
Yeah.
And so I'm just wondering, Devin, why you wanted to produce and direct True West?
Oh.
You know, and why now?
I'm glad to hear you've heard other, you know, seen other productions.
Oh, yeah, many.
Yeah, I've seen three professional productions and watched about five productions on tape. And this was over a course of a couple years. And I got kind of obsessed with the play because I loved how the humor and, you know, it's an actor's showcase, really, the play, I think. But the family dynamic was often lost. The kind of underbelly of, I think, what the play is really about. This is one of Sam Shepard's three family plays, and that can get lost amidst the humor and, you know, the great flights of fancy in the play. So we're trying to do it all. And I became, as a director, really interested in trying to do, stage the humor, the horror, and how parents brand their children.
Well, I'm not sure how Sam Shepard would like me saying this, but of all the plays, and I think I've seen every single one of his plays done in some production or other, mm-hmm. I think this one is actually the funniest.
I think so, too.
Yeah. I mean, not that he, maybe he intended it, but, you know, usually there's a little bit of humor in Sam Shepard plays, but this has quite a bit.
It's very funny. So is, I think Curse of the Starving Class is, too. But I also like to say that I think the great playwrights, like Shakespeare, like Hamlet's one of the funniest characters in all of Shakespeare. He says hilarious things. And there it is sitting in this, you know, fairly potent drama.
Well, you mentioned that True West is part of a trio or a trilogy of myths of American life and pop culture of plays. Curse of the Starving Class, which you mentioned, and Buried Child. You know, it's included usually that. But it also is included in actually a quintet, if you think about Fool for Love and A Lie of the Mind. I mean, he explores family and dynamics and history and relationships in all of those plays.
He does. Yeah, he really does. I would say in those three plays, the focus is very heavily on the parents, whereas in the other two plays you mentioned, the parents are present in their sometimes in their absence, but it's the love relationship between a man and a woman that's the focus of the family dynamic. Yeah,
And the parents are sort of in the B story. You know,
that's exactly right. The B side.
So I'm wondering if you can describe to me. Let's get Matt and Kenneth back in here. Your characters. If you were to start, Kenneth, who is Austin?
He's a sort of a mild-mannered, easygoing, everyman guy who's chasing his dream. Matt and I were talking last night, and Matt said something really funny and insightful that he's one of the more balanced Sam Shepard for the lion's share of the play. He's one of the more balanced and respectful, thoughtful Shepherd characters, I think.
So would he be considered the good son?
I think that...
Definitely, I think.
Yeah.
So he's the good son, and so who is Lee?
Well, I guess that would make me the bad son. Lee's pretty impulsive. Like you said, he's a drifter. He's a thief. He's also very intelligent. He's a survivor at heart. He knows kind of how to take what's in his immediate circumstances and use them to his best advantage. And in this play, he certainly does. Being close to his brother, who is a screenwriter, he kind of uses that to get close to a movie producer and eventually get himself a screenplay deal. And then hilarity ensues.
Well, I think it's an interesting, if you were to sort of, compare it to Sam Shepard's public and perhaps private selves, you know, the public maybe being the accomplished writer and, you know, who is able to present himself, you know, professionally, that would be Austin. And then Lee perhaps is more of his inner self, you know, what's going on in Shepard probably all the time.
Absolutely. Lee's got several things, several pieces of text about kind of not being able to live or function in society at large and not even wanting to sometimes. And I think that's a side of Shepard. I would posit that's a side of Shepard that's being expressed through the character.
And I think the conflict of business and art as well is a major theme in the play.
Business and art? In what way?
Well, in the way that on one hand you've got Austin who wants very much to be a writer of some substance, and yet he's having to exist in this, you know, in the Hollywood. He's got to make things that will sell, that Hollywood will buy.
And that's exactly the life of the professional writer,
right,
isn't it?
Right.
But then the inner part is like, why should I? You know, I want to go off in the desert and do something else.
Oh, sure.
So is that what makes, you know, Sam Shepard's writing so powerful? Those opposites, those conflicting, you know, those conflicting selves, the conflicting characters, they all seem to present one thing and then they actually are something else. You know, is what makes his writing so powerful?
Yeah, you asked early why this play now. I think it's even in some ways more germane now than even when he wrote it, because I feel like in a really funny and dark way, he's critiquing the quest for success and how we define success in our own lives. And I think that a lot of our general life out here, you know, not our private life, demands us to split off from ourselves in a way and put, you know, parts of ourselves kind of on a shelf for long periods of time that maybe we take out on vacations. And I think he's critiquing what the modern world demands of the human and demands of him. I've been reading a lot of his interviews in just doing research for the play, and not a completely happy camper. You know, he admits that, you know, he feels never quite comfortable wherever he is. Wherever he is, he wants to be somewhere else. You know, yeah, and he's an iconic figure for us. He's a larger than life figure, Sam Shepard. Yet at the same time, he has a string of failed relationships. He was arrested twice for drunk driving. He's a troubled cat in a lot of ways, as many of us are, you know.
And yet he's able to produce so much work.
Extraordinary talent.
And extraordinary work, too.
One of the great living writers.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
You know, True West is also an actor's play. I
mean,
is an actor's play. And the play first premiered at Magic Theater in San Francisco. It starred Peter Coyote at that time. Mm-hmm. And since then, there's a long history of top-notch actors like Tommy Lee Jones, of all people. I know. Imagine him doing that. And John Malkovich and Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Quaid Brothers did it.
And mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And, you know, Gary Sinise. And so I imagine this play, I'm talking to you guys, you actors, it's a bucket list, actually, for the coveted roles. It's on everybody,
every actor's
bucket list of coveted roles for male actors, I would think.
Definitely. I read something recently with an interview with Peter Dinklage of Game of Thrones. He's a great actor.
Oh, Peter, yes,
yeah.
Of course.
And he made a comment, and I think it was in the New York Times, this interview. He said that was one of the things that made him want to be an actor. And he said he felt like that was the case for a lot of male actors from his generation.
It would be interesting to see Peter Dinklage doing this, too.
Right?
Okay. I mean, has he done it? I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, because it really is. And I believe in the Broadway production, the most recent one with John C. Reilly and Philip Seymour Hoffman, they exchange roles all the time.
They did. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which you could do. Have you ever tried that as an exercise, exchanging
roles? I don't know how they did that.
It would be very hard.
Well, let's hear a scene that you have for us from True West that can be performed on the radio, because obviously, you know, there is a lot of, you know, it's realistic mm-hmm. language mm-hmm. in True West, but you've got a scene for us, and so would you set that up?
Sure. So in this scene, this is the fourth of nine scenes of the play. My character, Lee, has kind of swindled a little deal with Austin's producer, and Austin's producer has given me kind of credence to go ahead and write an outline of a story that I have in mind, a Western. So kind of against Austin's will, he's been put in the position to type this outline up for me.
There's the big brother thing again,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so this is my great American Western that I've been walking around with for years. You know, this is.
Okay. So this is a scene from True West.
Come on, Lee.
What do you mean, come on? That's what it is. Write it down. He's running out of gas.
It's too...
What? It's too what? It's too real? That's what you mean, isn't it? It's too much like real life.
It's not like real life. It's not enough like real life. Things don't happen like that.
What, men don't get with other men's women?
Yes, but they don't end up chasing each other across the panhandle through tornado country.
They do in this movie.
And they don't have horses conveniently along with them when they run out of gas. And they don't run out of gas either.
These guys run out of gas. This is my story, and one of these guys runs out of gas.
It's just a dumb excuse to get them into a chase scene. It's contrived.
It is a chase scene. It's already a chase scene. They've been chasing each other for days.
So now they're just supposed to abandon their trucks, climb on their horses, and chase each other into the mountains?
There aren't any mountains in the panhandle. It's flat. What? What is with these crickets? Shut up out there. This place is like a freaking rest home here. How are you supposed to think?
You want to take a break?
No, I don't want to take a break. I want to get this done. This is my last chance to get this done.
All right, take it easy.
I'm going to be leaving this area. I don't have time to mess around here.
Where are you going?
Never mind where I'm going. It's got nothing to do with you. I just got to get this done. I'm not like you, hanging around, being a parasite off of other fools. I just got to do this thing and get out.
A parasite? Me?
Yeah, you.
After you break into people's houses and take their televisions?
They don't need their televisions. I'm doing them a service.
Wow, you're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts here with director Devin Allen. And you just heard Matt DiBiasio and Kenneth Baldino performing a scene from True West, which previews Wednesday, July 24th, and that Wednesday preview is free on a first-come, first-served basis, and a paid preview, I believe, on Thursday.
Correct.
July 25th. And Thursday officially opens True West on True West actually opens on Friday, July 26th, and runs Thursdays through Sundays through August 18th. All shows are at Lincoln Performance Hall Studio Theater, located at 620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. For more info or reservations, visit ourshoesareRed.org. And we have all that info at stageandstudio.org. And we have a pair of tickets to offer to the fourth caller. Fourth caller, don't call yet, because here's the number. Two tickets to True West at 503-231-5106. 231-5106. Devin, in your writing about the play, you chose one Sam Shepard quote, and I'll just read the first part. I wanted to write a play about double nature, one that wouldn't be symbolic or metaphorical or any of that stuff. I just wanted to give a taste of what it feels like to be two-sided. Hmm. What does True West say about double nature?
I think it alludes to kind of what I said before, how we're split people. You know, to be out in this workaday world, we have to kind of be oneself. You can't really be like Lee and hold down a full-time job and show up on time and things like that. Yet Lee yearns for what Austin has, and Austin yearns for what Lee has. They're kind of two extremes of a way of being in the world. And, you know, when I watch it, I just wonder, is there a way to have, you know, kind of tease both those selves a little toward the center, not so extreme? I mean, I guess for me personally, the play's really about how can one live in this world and keep one's inner wildness alive, and also kind of unharness oneself from one's parental branding in a way. That said, the play's very funny. I don't want to sound like it's not, the darkness is like ballasts, but it's very, very funny, the play. Yeah.
Well, Matt and Kenneth, I mean, what is it like portraying this double nature as brothers? I mean, does it bring up any of your family history or dynamics for either of you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I could go on. Do you want to delve into that?
Yeah, it's. I think it's pretty rewarding and pretty cathartic, ultimately.
I mean, how could it not bring up family stuff?
Yeah, I mean,
how could it not?
I think, especially with Lee, he's got a lot at the beginning of the play. There's a lot of kind of self-worth stuff that gets brought up just being in the presence of his brother and his brother's success. And then to have that flip in the second act, and all of a sudden Lee's the one with the movie deal, he's the one on top, but he still doesn't have he doesn't have the tools to go through ultimately with this screenplay to write something that would be successful regardless of this opportunity that he's been given. It's interesting to play that kind of a character who's butting up against his own limits in that kind of way, and limits that are, I think, the play would say, because of his, you know, his childhood, his upbringing, and, you know, severe amounts of neglect or what have you.
Yeah, he sort of fell through the cracks, and Austin didn't somehow, you know. We in doing backstory with Lorraine Barr, who's playing the mother, who's so great, and Dennis Kelly, too. Playing Saul, we felt that what felt right to us was that, you know, the father had left around the time when, you know, you start getting a lot of attention about going to college and things like that. And when the father left, the family kind of fell apart and Lee kind of fell through the cracks, you know. Then later, Austin got the attention he needed with the mom was set up in her own house and things like that, right? So he's, you know, he comes from privilege. He went to an Ivy League school. The character of Lee is actually equally smart to Austin, if not more so. And you, and in a way, his language, if you look at it on the page, is much more creative than Austin's.
It's much more vibrant.
Much more vibrant.
And ultimately, I think that's why Saul, the producer, gravitates towards Lee.
Yeah. And one of the great switcheroos in the play, because, you know, they switch, is the switching. And I didn't realize this until about 2 weeks into rehearsal, the way they use language switches. So as Austin unburdens himself from the kind of constraints of this pressure, his language gets more and more compelling and artistic.
His voice.
He speaks more like an artist, you know. So just for artists everywhere, you know, what are these constraints on us? What do they do to us and our vision, you know? I mean, do we all have to go in the south of France and get our ear cut off to make great art?
I don't know. As a woman, I mean, I'm just kind of envious of these two roles because I think this play, it would be great to have the female equivalent of that.
Do you know, in my acting classes, women often do
the scenes
from this play.
I would be fascinating.
If they're pretty advanced, I let them do it. And let me tell you, it works.
Does it?
It's quite good.
Well, that's something you and I should talk about.
Maybe so.
I mean, do many women direct Sam Shepard plays?
Well, I'm going to truncate that sentence and say, do many women direct? You know,
that's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
But I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a siloing of, well, you're female, so you do more. You know,
right?
Like often I'm approached, sometimes in town. You know, to direct more kind of female issue plays, mm-hmm. things like that. Or it's the same with African Americans being asked to direct. Allison Hallett and the Portland Mercury made a great note about this in her column about why is it that, you know, the African American community is only acting in those plays and only directing plays with African Americans.
Because that's what's produced. And
well, that's
what's
it.
Been, you know.
Yeah, but they're not, I mean, the art of directing and excavating a role in acting is an imaginative leap. I've never thought that, oh, you have to be a man to really direct a male-based, you know, war film. You don't have to be a female to direct a more female.
That's a really good point because I think a lot of men will direct female issues, but it's not necessarily the opposite. That's why I asked you that.
Very
it's not necessarily the opposite.
I think that's
you think, oh, I have to get a director for Sam Shepard. I'm going to hire a woman.
It's more unusual, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
So is this something kind of freeing for you then? Or is
well,
it just...
Well, I make my own work, so it's why I have the lab. And I'm the lab was formed also to serve actors. I've had Ken in mind for this role for a very long time, and Matt too. So, part of my antidote to that with the lab is, just you know, we just do the work we want to do. But yeah, it's been free. It's great. It's
well,
really
let's talk about the history of the plays that you've done in Portland with Our Shoes Are Red, the performance lab. You've done Ursula, which is mostly female, and The Lime Tree Bower, which is all male, and now True West, which is mostly male. And so, you know, is there going to be a play in the works coming up where there's the same amount of men and women in it?
Oh.
interesting question. Yeah.
I want to do a play by a female writer. I mean, a lot of those writers are actually very, very strong male. I mean, Barker Shepherd, McPherson, strong male voices. And, you know, Devin directed Fefu over at PSU by Furness a little while ago, Maria Irene Furness. I really enjoyed going to see that. I was like, hey, it'd be great to act in something like that, you know. Where the genesis is coming from a you know
it's funny
female
you,
perspective.
It's funny you bring that up because I took one of Dime's workshops in you know grant writing and social media, which by the way I'm going to pitch this. These workshops are astonishingly great. It really helped me. And the pitch you may remember was that Irene Fornes play Enter the Night about doing it out in the barn, which is on my you know quote unquote bucket list as a director. So. Yeah,
and she needs to be done more often, I think here, so too. We'll catch Sam Shepard's True West, directed by Devin Allen, at Lincoln Performance Hall Studios Theater at 620 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Starts Wednesday, July 24th for a free preview. Opening night is Friday, July 26th, and runs Thursdays through Sundays through August 18th. All shows are at 8 p.m. For reservations, visit ourshoesarered.org, and I also have all of that at stageandstudio.org. Devin Allen, Matt DiBiasio, Kenneth Baldino, thanks for joining me today, and break legs.
Thank you, Dime. Thank you so much.
Next up, we hear from writer and radio producer Bing Bingham in Central Oregon with a new Writer's Read segment. We've all been feeling, well, you know, we've had spring fever. Now we're kind of right in the midst of summer, and he's got a message for us about lightening up.
I suppose I knew the lecture was coming. Stress kills, Dr. Beth said to me. She explained the biology, physiology, and pathology of a stressed human body. It would be up to me, she said, to do something about it. I needed to relax. If in doubt, a nap was in order. We'd had a tough winter, and there were too many things on my plate the following spring. My wife told me I was burning the candle at both ends and in the middle. I must have rolled my eyes in denial as I was leaving the doctor's office. She stopped me at the door. Do you need permission to take a break? She asked, already knowing the answer. She scribbled on a pad of paper and handed a prescription to me. It said, lie on the grass and look up at the sky and trees, 3 times per week, 1/2 hour each. On the bottom of the form, in the spot where it says refills, she made a small infinity sign. Once I had finished my baby boomer equivalent of, yeah, but, I stared in my mental mirror and decided she was probably right. Relaxing deep in the desert on a beautiful day? How hard could that be? On the inaugural of my stress relief program, I hopped on the ranch ATV and headed for our canyon. Meadowlarks were claiming territory around me, and a gentle breeze filled my nose with the smell of sun-warmed sage and juniper. I found a comfortable spot, stretched out, and fell asleep. After awakening, I noticed the meadowlarks were no longer singing. Then I felt a brief, slight chill of what seemed like the sun going behind a cloud. It happened again and again. Opening my eyes, I saw 3 buzzards circling directly overhead, like planes stacking up at the airport. To them, I must have looked like the carcass du jour. I'd never thought of myself as the main course in a buzzard banquet. I decided they needed to be taught a lesson. Quietly, watching through slitted eyes, I planned on luring them to the ground and suddenly leaping up, waving my arms, and hollering. It seemed like a fair exchange for my interrupted harmony and serenity session. However, many years of evolution taught buzzards to keep an eye open for signs of breathing. That's how they stay alive. Thinking about it from their point of view, food that doesn't breathe can't eat a buzzard. The buzzards and I had a waiting game going. They were going to circle until I expired, and I had no plans for expiration. This wasn't helping my stress levels. So I jumped up and watched them glide gracefully out of the canyon. About a week later, I spotted Dr. Beth in town and told her the story about being buzzard bait. She laughed until her eyes watered. I wasn't sure what I expected from her. An adjustment on the relaxation program or sympathy? She gave neither. It doesn't matter where you relax, she said, but you'll get more out of it if you look less like a carcass in a canyon. Let me know how it goes.
Bing Bingham lives on a remote ranch in northern central Oregon where he works as an independent writer, photographer, and radio producer. Bingham has a popular web column called Coffee Shop Moments, which takes place in the fictional Dusty Dog Cafe. Read more of his stories at bingbingham.com. And we'll have that link at stageandstudio.org. And before we go today, a shout out for Portland Shakespeare Project's The Taming of the Shrew. Artistic director Michael Mendelson does an amazing job directing a large ensemble of talented actors. The play is a version I haven't seen before, and it's filled with one comic moment after another. Taming of the Shrew is running in repertory with John Fletcher's The Tamer Tamed as a staged reading. Both shows at the Alder Stage at Artist Repertory Theater. Performances are Wednesday through Friday at 7:30. Saturday at 2 p.m. and 7:30 Sundays. And you can find out the schedule and info at portlandshakes.org. And hear the interview I did at stageandstudio.org. Thanks to engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of the show, visit stageandstudio.org. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 11:30. Coming up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Gallivan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. This week our guest is Mary Weaver Chapin, Curator of Graphic Arts at the Portland Art Museum. She's here to talk about artist and book 100 Years, which is at Portland Art Museum through September the 1st. Welcome, Mary. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
Thank you, Joseph.
First, I think we should define what an artist book is.
Well, the term artist book is notoriously difficult to define. There are volumes just dedicated to that term alone, trying to pin it down. But I think an easier way to talk about it is that artist books exist along a continuum. So at one end are conventional bound books that you and I would recognize that have original artwork illustrating or accompanying a text. That's something that we would recognize easily. Now, if you go down that continuum, there's a more avant-garde edge where an artist book could be a